Glad to be here today. I'll get this thing fixed where I won't back away from it. My name is John Million. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I'm also an addict, and you hear more about things that happened to me and what I'm really like. I don't know if I can tell you for sure, but I'm going to try. If I make it till next 18 years of sobriety, and each new year is a thrill, and each time I go to an area meeting or a group of people and meet new people, I get a kind of a rejuvenation in AA, something that's sort of reborn, I guess, every day. They told me to do this way if I stayed in it, and it has turned out that way. I was dead before I came here, and I've been alive since I've been good, and I don't want to die again the same way I did the first time. When I die again, I want it to be with this natural process, and with me right, with myself and my fellow man and my God. And you people are the ones that have shown me how to keep things right that way. I don't want to go back to this other. I want to stay sober. They told me I had an illness that was permanent, that I would never get over it. That I could wreck it all by taking a drink of liquor. I could wreck my sobriety, my life, and everything, and go right back to the old way. And I believe you. And I still believe you. And I still go to AA for me nearly every day in some way for that purpose. You get ready to talk and you don't know hardly how to describe what you were. I want to tell a little story that some of you have heard, but it kind of sums up what I was, kind of fellow I am and what I was like. There was a guy that was losing his hair, and he kept losing it, and finally he lost it all, but he had only one hair left in the top of his head, and that's all that was there. One little old hair, and he was extremely fond of this hair. And he took care of it. He coiled it up at night when he went to bed and put a little grease on it. And the next day when he went out, he put a hat on it. And he'd take his hat off and look during the day to see if it was still there. The night when he went to bed, he would rub a little massage the area around it, and then he would rub little lotions on it, coil it up again, and go back to bed. The next morning, the first thing he did, he would rush into the bathroom and unwind his hair, massage it some more, and then get ready for the next day. One morning he woke up, and there on the pillow by his head was the hair. And he looked at it, and he tears in his eyes, and he went in the bathroom and he looked at his head and he said, "My God, I'm bald." This is by the way it was with me. Everybody else knew I was bald before I did. I kept holding on to the idea that maybe there's some way that I could direct this stuff. But there wasn't. I had my life mixed up from the time I first started drinking. My father wrote me a little letter when I was overseas and a joke in it during World War II about another fellow that was overseas, and he'd written a letter to his father. And this guy wrote his daddy. He says, "Daddy, I can't tell you where I am, but I shot a polar bear yesterday." And a few weeks later, he got another letter from his son, and he said, "Daddy, I've been transferred. I can't tell you where I am, but I danced with a hula girl yesterday." And a few weeks later, he got another letter and says, "Daddy, I've been transferred. I can't tell you where I am, but I'm in a hospital, and I should have danced with the polar bear and shot the hula girl." My life was a story of doing the wrong thing. Doing the wrong thing. I wanted to be a good doctor and a good father and a good husband, a good church man, a good citizen, and drink whiskey. I wanted alcohol as part of a good life. It made me feel good. It gave me a glow inside that was tremendous, and I thought this was great, and I wanted it as part of the good life that I was leading. One time at Emory, when I was in school there, I heard a fellow from one of the visiting lecturers who talked about this, and he said there are three marks of an educated man. He says he is a scholar, that he has high social aspirations, and he's a judge of good whiskey. And I said, "That's me, you know, that's what I want, you know, I mean, especially this part about being a judge of good whiskey." And for a long time, I believed that if you drank good whiskey, it wouldn't cause any trouble. I said the stuff that causes the trouble is the butyl oil and all the impurities that you find in corn liquor and this stuff you buy on the back street. If you drink the bonded liquor, if you drink at the country club, it's okay. And I thought it carried this notion of me right on up to the end. Last drink I ever took was Canadian Club. I was trying to drink the best I could get at the time because I hung on to this idea that it wasn't alcohol, in spite of the evidence that it was. Alcohol changed me from the beginning. I was one person until I started drinking, and I became a different person after I started drinking. My own experience that I had with it makes me appreciate the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde a little more, because this is what that chemical does to it. It produced a different personality, a different system of values and things. Before I took my first drink, at about 18 years of age, I didn't think anybody ought to drink. I was opposed to it. I was a prohibitionist. I was against alcohol. And I could see no earthly reason for anybody drinking. When I took my first drink, this stuff did so much for me, it picked me up and put me on a plateau of feeling I'd never been on before, and I thought everybody ought to drink. Changed completely. I had a different system of values. I included this chemical in there because of what it did to me personally. It did certain things. It took away some things and it added others. After, I guess it must have been about 1960, I read an advertisement of a drug one time in a medical journal. The drug was Librium. And this advertisement said, this drug will do four things for you. It will relieve tension and anxiety. It will impart a sense of well-being. And it will promote restful sleep. And it will improve interpersonal relationships. I looked at that thing and I said, by golly, that's exactly what alcohol did for me. Alcohol relieved tension and anxiety. It imparted a sense of well-being. It promoted restful sleep, and it improved my communication with other people. I enjoyed talking to people more with a few drinks. It gave conviviality. And now, since I have been in AA, I have discovered that this is also what the AA program does. That by working these 12 steps, I have it's kind of been bestowed upon me through the fellowship, a sense of well-being and relief of tension and anxiety, and the capability to lie down comfortably at night and sleep, and certainly it has improved my ability to communicate with other people, and it's been a wonderful experience enjoying the interpersonal relationship. And I discovered that the fellowship of AA does the same things for me that the drugs and the alcohol used to do. And I learned from the very beginning when I first came in, my sponsor told me it would do this. I have come to believe that he is right. But he told me also that if I chose to get these things through chemicals, I could not have them through the fellowship. That I had to give up. Had to give up my chemicals and had to give up the glow. And give up that sense of well-being, that high, we call it, that we got from it. Had to be willing to give up these other things in order to achieve it through AA, that I couldn't have it both ways. He impressed upon me the totality of this illness, of the fact that we can't have sobriety and drink whiskey. One fellow said, if you're having trouble with the AA program, check your drinking. You may be drinking too much. And this is it. You laugh, but you know it's true. There's a lot to it. That leaving off, you know, this program is not a program to keep you sober. They told me that, and I believed it. It's a program for sobriety that will improve your life and give you a different system of values and give you something to live by, and it will work for you, provided you don't drink. But leaving off the alcohol is a condition of recovery rather than an objective. And every other place I'd ever been before then, I had looked for that place to cure me. I went in there, and I was drinking. And I went to all their meetings, and I listened to all of their lectures, and I talked to the psychiatrist, and I walked out, and I got drunk, and I said, it wouldn't help me because I'm still drunk. And I blamed it on the fellas. And AA is the first place they told me that I had to be responsible for my own drinking. I had to be responsible for my own sobriety. And when I began to be willing to let it look at me, I found some recovery from it. It took a complete change in my attitude, and also myself and this illness in order to find somebody through the program. But the beautiful thing about it is that when you are willing to let your attitude change, the program works. And they told me I could have somebody, and I found it. My first contact was alcohol. It was rather dramatic. It was at a dance in Avondale Country Club in Atlanta. I had all these other ideas, and I took it, I think, through curiosity. I took this thing. The high was so good, and I felt so good that I couldn't wait to take another one. And I just kept drinking. I had a blackout. I forgot what happened the latter part of the evening. They tell me I passed out. They carried me home to the fraternity house and put me to bed. And I woke up the next morning with a hangover, sick, miserable, and quit. Everything in there is a symptom of alcoholism, but it took me 30 years to recognize it. 6 months later, I go back and do the same thing again, and I quit again. A little later, I got serious about it. And I said, look, you got to be careful. You got to watch this stuff. And I set out on years and years of controlled drinking. Alcoholism, controlled and uncontrolled drinking, that's what I was doing. Pretty good control over the years in the beginning, and toward the end, almost no control. High capacity, I had in the beginning, but virtually none toward the end. And it was a losing battle for me from the start. I finished Emory. I got married to an Atlanta girl. She came to State Farm and started practicing medicine. And I said, now it's going to be different. I'm going to settle down, and I'm not going to drink, because I don't want to drink and practice medicine. And so it lasted about 2 or 3 weeks. But I found that the stresses and strains of practicing medicine were worse than they were in Atlanta. And so I started drinking again at intervals, because I felt like I had to. We went on, the World War II came along, I went there. I think I went partly to get away from practicing myself. And I drank there. I stayed 4 years. I came out a hard alcoholic and didn't know it. Things happened overseas that I should have known of what was wrong, but I couldn't see it. I got involved in pills then too, and amphetamines and things like this overseas. And things changed for me. They changed for me overseas when it was different. I began to get personality changes from it.
Is that
out here? Something's bothering me there.
You understand?
Something in these pictures. Some play in the music. Remember, there's somebody talking. Somebody's talking in the pictures. It's up besides me, though. Okay, that's good enough. I got to listen to that, and you know, hear my train of thought. That's all right. I talked over intercom one night, had symphony off the play. But I got overseas, and I got to, they would give me things to do, and they noticed the effect that alcohol had on me. They said, John, if you want something done, give John a few drinks and send him. If you want something from the quartermaster, give John a few drinks and send him. They discovered that there was some liquor that they'd found up in one of the seaports there. They were wondering how to get it. Give John a few drinks and send it. And that was true. They would send me to the quartermaster, and I was a captain. And the minute I took those three drinks, two or three drinks anyway, those bars on my shoulders turned to stars, you know, and I became General Mooney, and I really believed this thing. And I'd go in and I would demand stuff, and I would get it, you know, because I was convinced, because I was believing my own delusion. And this went on. I came back from overseas with a bad problem. I had a falling out with my wife because I began to blame my own character defects on her through a process of rejection. I accused her of a lot of things. And so we got a divorce, and couldn't stand it any longer. I've never seen it since. In a short time, I met Doc, and we began to go together. And we drank together, and we came into AA together, and she has said in her talk many times that anybody who had as much trouble as Gordon ought to have better sense than to get married. But we sweated it out, and things have worked out pretty good for us over the years. It was about this time that I began to run into the serious problem with the alcohol interfering with the practice of medicine. I got drunk and I went down to Florida one time to try to get off of my alcohol. And I went in a hospital, got a doctor there in Tampa to help me. And he put me in a hospital and started treating me, and I had the DTs for the first time. First time I'd ever really had it. I'd had little hallucinations and things like this, but this time it was too real. I was lying there in that hospital bed. I looked up and I saw some cockroaches, as big as jackrabbits. They climbed up the curtain and got to the top and fell off on the bed. And I knew that cockroaches didn't get that big, so I said, this is an hallucination. So I kicked them off on the floor. And they went up and kept doing the same thing, but they weren't bothering me. It was rather interesting. And I said, well, this is what it'll do for you. I've got to be careful about my drinking. And after a while, I was lying there, and I heard these voices out in the hall. I said, gosh, that's somebody I know. And I heard two or three people talking, and they were talking about me. And I went over and opened the door to the hospital room out in the hall. There was nobody there. So I went back. As soon as I closed the door, I started talking again. So I went back over a little quicker, you know, and opened the door. Nobody there. As soon as I closed that door, they started back talking about me and about how they felt about me, and they were laughing, and I couldn't understand it. So I went over and put my hand on the door very carefully, and then I jerked it open and looked out there, and there's nobody there. So I said, gosh, I am having all kinds of trouble here. And so I went down to the lounge, and I lit a cigarette, and I started drinking. And while I was in there, all these people that had been in the hall all came in. And they came down and started talking to me, and I asked them, how'd y'all get out of that hall so quick? They said, oh, wouldn't you like to know? They were teasing me. They were friends that said they chartered a bus, and had come down here to Tampa just to see how I was getting along. And the nurse came down and saw me talking there, and so I introduced her to these people. She said, are you feeling all right? I said, yes. I just want you to meet my friends. It seemed like they're really going out of their way to come do this. So let's go back to your room. So she went back, gave me a shot, and when I woke up from the shot, the people were gone. And I learned one thing from that, though, is that these hallucinations are real. And when a guy, several years later, after I sobered up, I was sitting in the hospital, and I came by his room one day, and he was sitting there on the side of the bed, and he was doing like this. I said, what's the matter? He says, matter, man, don't you see these lizards? They're about to take over, and I can't get them out. So I sat there, and he and I pulled lizards out of his pajamas for about 30 minutes. I couldn't see those lizards, but I knew they were there. He saw them, but I did the same thing. I came back after that. I tried to work, and I would try to practice medicine, and it got worse and worse. The ability to do something. I got in the habit of failure. I couldn't finish anything. And even when I started something, I knew it wasn't going to go through. I wasn't going to finish it. Of being deep in debt and trying to pull out. I kept wanting to make a living, to make some money, you know. I had some children coming up, and I wanted to send these children to college. And yet there was nothing there. And I was deeper in debt. I had one thing that I didn't want to do. I didn't want my family to go without shelter. And so the first thing I paid after my liquor and dope, of course, was the rent, the payment on the house. And then I would pay this every month, and sometimes I'd have to let other things go. And finally the gasoline bill, the grocery bill, various things would pile up, and I didn't have the money to pay them. And then I would borrow money on the house and make these payments, and then keep paying on the house. And I kept doing this over the years. And show you what the way the thing worked. In 1938, when I built that house, it cost $7,500 for the house, the lot, and all the equipment in it there. And I borrowed this from first one place, and later on the loan was transferred to the Jefferson Standard Life Insurance Company. And I paid on it year after year after year. In 1965, which is some 27 years later, when we were going to remodel the house, and we checked into the loan to see how much I still owed on it, I owed $5,000. I paid $2,300 off this thing, $2,500 off this thing in 27 years. And that's the way it was. That was the kind of thing. And me a doctor now, working every day, seeing patients, writing prescriptions, doing surgery, felt like I was just working all the time,
and make him nothing. You know, this is hard to do.
It's hard to do. Well, most doctors, if you just take a prescription pad and a ballpoint pen, you can make some beat that way. You don't have to have anything but a stethoscope. You don't need that. But I had all the stuff, and I'm paying a lot of salaries on nurses to help me, seeing a lot of people, and failing. And it was a terrible thing because I didn't want to fail. I wanted to succeed, and I began to get this hopeless feeling. In the meantime, I'd been repeatedly in hospitals trying to get off of it. I had a convulsion the first time and broke a vertebra, and then from that time on, it was one psychiatric hospital after the other. I didn't tell them what I was taking, but the convulsion was due to drugs that I was taking. All types of drugs. If it would change the mood, if it would have it for me, I'd try. And there wasn't any limit to the drugs I didn't use. I became completely drug dependent and trying to get the drugs balanced up right to where I could function and go and work. And then getting worse and worse and just going to the point of giving up. They stopped selling me narcotics because I was using too much. And all six drug stores got together in a group and came to see me and said no more. I started getting them through illegal sources, not through pushers, but through my own prescriptions, because I still had it, but prescriptions written to fictitious people, which is illegal, misusing my narcotic privilege. And I started getting on wholesale, too, from drug houses and keeping no records. And I knew that I was in bad trouble legally if they caught this thing. It got worse and worse, and the more I would try to get better, the worse I'd get. The spring of 1959, something happened to me. I don't know what it was. I call it a spiritual experience. You know, this program says a spiritual experience is what you call it. It says God as we understood it. There's a story about three umpires who were talking about balls and strikes. And one of them says, I call them like I see them. The other one said, I call them like they are. The third one says, they ain't nothing till I call it. Think about it. Spiritual experience is whatever you call that, you know. It's whatever you want to say. This is a spiritual experience. Remember, this program, as I understand it, nobody can challenge this at all because it says that we understood it. And I had a spiritual experience, and I was riding down Savannah Avenue one day, as I recall it, and I got this. Something happened to me, and I said, look, I don't want to live this way anymore. I got a desire for something better. I don't think I gave myself this desire. I thank my God as I understand and communicated this to me. So that's when my recovery, whatever recovery I have today, began, was with that feeling that I want out of this mess. I don't want to live this way anymore. I had for a long time felt like I ought to get out of it. It ain't the proper way for a guy to live. But there was something in me inside that held on to it. And I think that was released that day when I said, I want to get out of this thing. I had sent a man to Lexington, Kentucky, at the U.S. Public Health Service Hospital, and he had gotten better. And so I told out I was going. So I went up to Lexington. I was a volunteer. It's a federal penitentiary for the treatment of narcotic addicts. They take people doing 20 years in there or longer on federal and state charges, but they also take volunteers who want to try to help themselves. And I went as a volunteer. I've always had a feeling back then that I was different. I wasn't like other people. I didn't know that I had this. A preacher told me this one time. I'd been drunk, and I was over here at Fort Valley in the hospital, and this preacher, who some of you may know around here, was Lawrence Houston. And Lawrence came and got me. And Lawrence took me home, and when Lawrence was riding down the road, he says, John, I'll tell you what's the matter with you. You think you're something special. You think you've got special talents, special abilities other people don't have. He says, you've got to realize that you ain't nobody but plain old John Mooney, that you don't have anything everybody else doesn't have. I said, preacher, I'd like to believe you, but that's just not true. And Lawrence shook his head. And I know that he knew that as long as I had an attitude like that, that I was something apart from the human race, that I had no chance for the recovery. And that's the way it was. Well, the first visit to Lexington up there, that time that I stayed as a volunteer, began to cut away at this pride and all that was destroying me, this pride that was giving me ideas about myself that I just described. And I had these, you know.
you come to see me with an illness, and suppose you've got a sore throat, and I give you an antibiotic, and I say, go take this antibiotic. Now, one capsule every 6 hours by the clock. And I expect you to do it, and you will do it, because the doctor said so. I get the same type of sore throat, and I decide that I need the same antibiotic. Do I take it the same way? No. I take a handful frequently. I don't go by these rigid things, because I get the feeling inside that it's not going to do me the same way it does you, when actually there's no difference in us whatsoever. And so this is what had to go, this price. Something had to happen to it. And I went in there expecting to be treated in keeping with my professional reputation. Most of the places, you know, you go into a hospital, they give the doctor a private room and give him a little, maybe a special nurse called to look after him and give him special attention. And I'd usually got that. Well, I didn't get much special attention in this place. They took my clothes off and they put me on a uniform on. And they lined me up there with a bunch of dope fiends from New York and Puerto Rico. And they gave me a number. Number 58520. I had this feeling if they'd have called me Dr. 58520, it wouldn't be so bad. But they didn't do that. Plain old 58520. Incidentally, one of them, a couple of my staff members presented me with a little plaque to go on my desk this past Christmas that said Dr. 58520. But this humiliated me. They're putting me and classifying me as a common dope fiend. And I don't have this. I got an education. And they don't know who I am. I stayed a week in there and I couldn't stand it and I left. And I swore I'd never drink again as long as I live or take any more dope, that I wasn't going to let myself get to be like those people. I was drunk the same day I got out. When I took the first drink of this last drunk, I had a feeling of panic that I know now was due to the fact that I realized that I had to go back there. There was no way to stay out. That there was no difference. There was no way that I could stay sober. That drunk lasted 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, and during that time, a lot happened to me to cut away at this price. I was determined to stay sober, and I couldn't. I was drinking the same day. I said, I've had no trouble, so I had some trouble. I got out and I found out that they had picked up these prescriptions that I had written, and I was indicted by the grand jury and convicted of a felony. I was sentenced to 2 years at the Georgia prison at Reedsville. All this happened in that 2 weeks. But there was something looking after me. The judge says, John, I'm not going to make you serve this term. I'm going to let you go back to Lexington. I will probate this sentence if you will return to Lexington and stay there until these doctors release you. So I went back to Lexington under those conditions. I went back to Lexington as a convicted felon. I went back to Lexington realizing it was what I had. I could not stay sober in hospital, realizing I needed what it was that they had there. And I went back to Lexington feeling comfortable with the other people that were there. They welcomed me back as one of the brethren had come. And they were kind and they laughed and they said, my sponsor later said, everybody has to reach this point. And AA, I heard it said later, you've got to get ready. And during that 2 weeks, a lot of what happened to me is get ready for sobriety, to get rid of this feeling of something special about myself, this pride, this arrogance, and all this, the feeling that there was some other way to do it. I tried any way in the world to get sober except to face myself in my own responsibility and pardon my drunkenness. And this I learned I had to do. I knew there wasn't any way in the world to try anywhere else, that I had to go back. I had an alternative to go where I could go at that time, and that was prison. I didn't want to go there. When I left the first time, sir, they talked to me, and they made me sign a little slip of paper that I was leaving and get medical advice. And this doctor says, John, I wish you'd stay. I wish you'd stay, because if you don't stay now, you're going to be back here inside of a year on a court order. And I thought he was crazy. I was back in 2 weeks on the court order. This has more meaning to me, because it means that we don't ever know what's just around the corner. Yeah? You don't know what's about to happen. We've seen this repeatedly over the years. In my own experience, too, there's no way to know how far along we are. Some certain illnesses somebody can get, and the doctor can say, well, I'll give you a medical sign that says you'll live probably 6 months. And when a doctor actually ventures that, usually he's approximately right, because some of the things that happen you can predict. But there's no way to predict what's going to happen. We could be going along happy, feeling good, thinking everything's all right, and if we're alcoholics, something can happen and we could be dead from alcoholism the next day or that same day. I didn't have any idea that all these court things were about to descend upon me, and there they were, all the trouble hanging right there. And so I learned something about that, to realize what a close call I had. I thought I wasn't very bad off, but I found out later I was in terminal stages of the illness. I went back and I asked the psychiatric here, and they did a thorough study on my history and said the only thing we can do for you here in that way is a complete psychoanalysis. It'll take several years. If you will agree to stay that long, we will give it to you free. I knew I wouldn't do it, and I turned it down because I knew I wouldn't stay that long. They said, you better go to AA because there's nowhere else for you to go. So that's the way I came here. I came here desperate, looking for help. I came here when all other avenues of help had been closed to me. Either had been shown that they couldn't work for me or refused to be offered to me on my terms. I came in a state of desperation. I knew that I was way down the line of this thing, and I think this is the proper way to come. I thought it was miserable. I didn't see how I could survive. And when I told my sponsor there how I felt, he says, I felt that great. I couldn't see anything great about it, but I knew what he meant by the unmanageability of my life. It was right there. Powerlessness and unmanageability. No way to stay sober. No way to work my way out of it. Help this. And he says, that's great because you're ready for the program. He told me I could make a history of myself and there I could take the fourth step and learn something. I could use that time, or I could throw it away. And I chose to lose use it. And I made a study of me. And I found out some things I didn't know. As time went on, I found out a little deeper knowledge of this thing. I thought maybe I hadn't. When I came into place the second time, they asked me how long I had a problem. I said about 2 weeks. And that was when all the trouble started, I thought. When I looked at it again, I discovered that I got a problem since that first drink. That's what the inventory did for me then. I came along, I got out to 4.5 months. Very frightened. I mean, I didn't want to leave. I was scared because I took enough inventory to know I might get drunk. But he arranged me to go to an outside meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first one I'd ever been to of AA, as it is here. I'd been going in the institution, the Addicts Anonymous, which is AA, but which deals alcohol and drugs, and most fellows couldn't get out anyway, were there, and they didn't have access to drugs. A little different. But that first meeting that he took me to a few days before I was going to leave gave me an idea of what AA was like, and I gained strength enough from that meeting to leave the hospital. I left 3 days later, upset, miserable, determined to go back to Statesboro and prove to people there that I could stay sober. To show people there where I had loused up my life, that I could walk the streets with my head up with sobriety and could behave like a responsible citizen and physician. This is an attitude of pride that's going to go prove things to people, I think. I didn't have enough to do it. I wound up in Atlanta. I had a ticket where Scott was going to meet me on the airplane in Savannah, and I could not go up the steps of that airplane. Gave my ticket away. They gave me a ticket on a plane leaving the next morning. I went into a virtual panic. I found myself in a motel room on the second floor, getting into a depression because for the first time in my life, I was determined to do something and I couldn't do it. Physically, I was unable to board the airplane. And this had never happened to me. Even in war, I had been in combat parachute something. And operations and under fire, and had been able to do it, scared as I was. But with no fire, or anything else, it was just the pride wasn't there. I think it was pride that was going to make me do it, and I didn't have enough left to go down there and show anybody anything. When there was nowhere else to turn, I went into a state of being where I came the closest to destroying myself I ever had. But something happened to me, I guess, and I fell down on my knees by the bed and asked God to help me. I think it's the only time I've ever made a prayer just like that. I didn't have any ideas of what I wanted him to do for me. I didn't have any plan for any but a prayer of desperation and surrender that there was nothing left in me, nowhere left to turn, and I wanted help. And I think that I had at the moment something I never had before, and I know I've never had it since, and that's humility. And when I said these words, something very dramatic happened in my life. I had a feeling of a presence in that room with me. I had an uplifted feeling of ecstasy. It seemed to pick me up and envelop me in that thing with a feeling that the knowledge that everything's going to be all right, that you don't have anything to worry about. To me, this was an experience with God as I understand Him, and out of it came a loss of the desire, the craving to drink. I heard Chuck one time, a priest in California, describe alcoholism as the almost disease. And when he said that word, it reminded me of that feeling in that room and how it applied to the sensation I had. Alcohol with me was always incomplete. It didn't quite do the job. When I took a drink, I'd feel so high and feel so good, but not quite high enough or good enough, so I'd take another one, and maybe a little more. But I never got the fulfillment of what I wanted. It was a stretch, and I was looking for something, and just before I got it, I'd pass out, wake up with a hangover, and start over again. Bob W. from down in Marshmallow, he says, you put the marshmallow in front of the fire by the coals, and it turns brown, and just about the time it gets right and you're ready to eat it, it catches on fire and burns up. And this is the way it was until then. And in that motel room that night, with no alcohol and with a clear mind, and with this experience that I had there, I had a fulfillment of this desire, and I realized that I was looking for God and looking for a spiritual experience in the bottle. This is my story that I'm telling, because it's the way I feel about the illness as it has occurred in me. And I've never had a craving or anything for alcohol since then. Now, I'm not going to say I haven't wanted a drink or had a desire for a drink, because that wouldn't be true. But I've been on some hot days, and I've bought some of these signs on the highway with all this beer, and there's an icy crystals on the side that would look mighty good to me, and I'm glad there wasn't nothing in the dark while I was riding along that thing. But I haven't had to fight it like some people say they have. I extended this thing to all these drugs because I couldn't see any difference to me between what the drugs did, the tranquilizers, the sedatives, the narcotics, the alcohol. It was all the same. I couldn't draw a line as to what was a safe drug to me and wasn't. So I left them all off. I don't even take an aspirin tablet. Didn't for 13 years. And I got sick and had to take a few 3 or 4 years ago. I used to talk a lot in AA meetings about not taking any aspirin. But I don't do that anymore, because a guy came up to me after a meeting one time and he says, Doc, you sure will have you up me. So I'm still drinking a little liquor, but I ain't taking no aspirin. I slept that night. I got up the next morning, no problem at all. I got on the plane and I went there and Doc met me. I went home. I had a feeling that I had something real special. And I think I entered a real critical period of my life that could have destroyed me. To feel like a spiritual experience is going to keep you sober. And I know now it won't do it. If you can have 100 of these things, it doesn't guarantee any surprise. It's something that we can get that I had happen to me. I've heard other people describe it. It gives you an understanding about the power of the program as it affects me. And it took away this craving for drink. It stopped the battle there. But it would not have kept me sober. But I had a feeling that this is what I need, that I've got something special. It had been recommended to me that I go to AA as soon as I got stable. And I told myself, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go to AA and I'm going to tell all the AAs about this wonderful spiritual experience I've had. And I'm sure that this could help them, because I doubt if any of them ever had anything like it happen to them, so that this could be really good. I'm going to go to AA the first chance I get. My sponsor had told me that he went 6-7 meetings a week. And at the time he told me that, I thought to myself, you know, this is great, this man do that, but he's retired. He's been sober 6 to 18, 20 years. But I'm just sober, just coming out of here now, and I've got some little children to feed, and I've got to practice to get back together. And I've got some other things that, so we got to eat, we got to have clothes, and I'm going to go do this. And I'm going to AA, I'm going to put it first. And I'm going to AA, I'm going at least once a month. And then when I get the little things established a little bit, then all, I'm going to go more often than that. And this was the idea I had about it. And I think had something else not happened to me, that would have destroyed me. I think I could have gone, I could have sat around bars drinking liquor the rest of my life and talked about a spiritual experience and died that way, because I don't think that's where the salvation is. I think it comes from our reaction to this total program. It's a program of living 24 hours a day, of knowing what you need in your value system. And my value system was upside down. I would never have admitted it to you, but I was putting the practice of medicine ahead of my AA, because I was going to go to what AA, the practice would leave me time to go to. But I thought that was all that's necessary. If I, like everybody, go to church once a week, you know, they don't spend 6 days going to church and once a week working. It's the other way around. You get this little sustaining thing every Sunday that carries you through the week. And AA would get a sustaining meeting once a month and take you through the month. And I got all kinds of ideas that were sitting around my head I guess they were suicide. I didn't know it. But something else happened to me. I think it's great that God don't pay no attention to some of our mental gymnastics that we go through, call them rationalization, keep doing things we ought to do. I got a message to go to Atlanta to the State Board of Medical Examiners. I went up there, and it said, "Dr. Noonan, you have been convicted of a felony." And they revoked my license to practice medicine. But under the laws of Georgia, you cannot practice medicine without on your record. It must be revoked. But you can apply for reinstatement in 6 months. And I left that capital that day for that board. There was no way in the world to practice medicine. Thank God for this. At the time, I thought it was the worst calamity that had ever happened. So how are we going to eat? How am I going to feed myself? No way. But I didn't get drunk. I had enough of the program to know one thing that you had told me, that there's something good about everything, no matter how bad it looks. And I think I sort of hung on to this, and I went down, and I sat down at my desk and wondered what I would do. I let my nurse go, and I turned down the appointment to close the office practice. And I was sitting at my desk wondering what to do, and a man's name flashed into my mind. His name was Henry. Henry came to see me about a year and a half before when I was drunk. On Saturday afternoon, I was sitting in my living room, drunk, watching the test pattern on television, which I like to do, and Dot had gone out to her mother's with the children, and the house was dirty, and it was trash all over it, and I was just sitting there drinking liquor, and Henry walked in. And Henry was a friend of mine that I'd known all my life, and Henry had a bad drinking problem. And Henry walked in with a clean suit and a clean shirt and a tie, and he said, "John, I want to talk to you. I want to tell you what happened to me." He said, "You know the problem I've had with liquor." And I said, "I sure do, Henry. I'd give anything in the world to get you that problem if I could." He said, "Well, I've gotten some help." He said, "I've joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's made a new life for me." And he told me all about it. And he presented this thing in such a way that I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever heard of for alcoholics. And he said that finally, toward the end, he said, "John, would you like to come to a meeting?" I said, "Henry, I certainly would. Because I believe that alcoholism is one of the worst diseases, it's the worst curses we have in this country, and I'll do anything to help somebody that's trying to do something about it. And if you set the meeting up, I'll go up there and lecture to you on this illness anytime you want me to." And Henry left, and that was all. But that day when I was sitting in that desk, he was the only name I knew of anybody that belonged to the Stakenborough group. And I called him. And Henry was there in 5 minutes. And he took me to my first AA meeting in Statesboro the next night. We met in there. Dot went with me. We went, there must have been 15 or 16 people in the group. And they asked me to say a few words. And I did. I gave a 10-minute talk, as I recall, not that long, on the rehabilitation program in Lexington. I've since been told it's the worst AA talk ever made in South Georgia. And it got the attention of some other people there. One in particular, and his wife, a man named C.D., and you know C.D., was over here last week, I think, it said, Canada. And C.D. wears a little hat. He wears a hat everywhere. He smoked a cigar. He don't smoke a cigar anymore. But after the meeting was over, he came up, and he didn't criticize my talk or anything. He said, "What you doing tonight?" "Nothing." "Come on over to the house." So went over there, and they played a tape, and then we talked. And finally, in the early 8 hours of the morning, we went home. He said, "What you doing tomorrow night?" "Nothing." "We'll pick you up at 7 o'clock. We're going to Savannah." So the next night, they picked us up at 7 o'clock in a little old Foxhall automobile, and we went to Savannah. He came back that night. What you doing tomorrow night?
Nothing.
We picked you up. We're going to Augusta. And these people came into our lives and gave us enthusiasm. They told us sort of what it meant to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous every day. To set how to incorporate these things into the process of daily living. And they gave us enthusiasm and they introduced us and they widened our horizons. Before that, my AA for the prison group at Lexington, one meeting in Lexington downtown, and then a book and study. I memorized the 12 steps, this sort of thing, and that was it. As they took us in charge and began to carry us, they introduced us to AA as it really is and showed us the magnitude of this beautiful fellowship and what it does. And we went everywhere. We went and went and went. I ran into something after a while, after several weeks or months of this, which you might happen to you if you're a new person. I began to get saturated with AA. I began to get a little bored. I began to get aware of the limitations of the program. I began to get critical of the big book, and I saw some places in there where I thought Bill hadn't used the right language, and that maybe if he could make some little revisions, that it would improve it. I wanted to add some to it. And I said, you need more of a program. All they've got is 12 steps. And when you get through the 12 steps, you go back and start throwing out the first steps. And there should be something else to add in here. Maybe a 13th or 14th step in some way. I began to get these ideas. And I began to get critical of what was happening. And I got upset about the thing. Felt like that AA, that I was getting too much AA, more than I could assimilate. And one morning I was sitting downtown talking to another fellow who had come in at the same time that we did. And he began to voice these feelings. He says, "Ron, you know CD is a fanatic." I said, "He sure is. He says, one man is." And I said, "You know what I think he's a fanatic?" He said, "I think I need a little rest. I'm going to take a vacation for a few days from it, and then it's not going for a little while, and then try to get it together and talk about next week." So I went, "You know, that's a good idea. You seem to be doing well. I'm going to do the same thing." So I went home that night. Instead of getting ready, I took my shoes off and I sat down on the bed. And I told God that I thought I was going to stay home and watch television. I said, "Honey, I haven't seen gun smoke on how long. I don't know what's happening on the news." And he was standing up in front of the mirror there, putting in our earrings. And I expected her to stop and take all the shoes and stretch out on the bed and say, "Honey, that's a good idea. We'll just rest a few days and then maybe go in the next shoes or something." But she didn't do that. She kept right on putting in those little earrings and turned around to me and said, "You can stay here and watch television if you want to, but I'm going to bed in the book." And I got a little puppy dog and put my shoes on and I went with it. And that night she came back and I felt better. It was a good meeting. The next morning somebody called up and said the fellow I'd been talking to the day before got drunk that night. And this scared me. It really frightened me because I almost did the same thing I realized now. And I realized that what he had said about AA is true. But something he hadn't said is that when it's running out your ears, it ain't getting to your brain. But it don't get there. And I remember that over the years. That when I feel like I'm getting too much AA, too much out of it, that I need to go back and examine it because I may not be getting any. The only thing that stands between me and a drink of liquor is the power of this program because I don't have any power left in me yet to resist it. It isn't there. It's gone. And it's been gone. I used this up before I came here. If there's been any way in the world to have stayed sober, I wouldn't have been back in Lexington that second time. And I wouldn't be here with you now. During that 6 months, I learned of my position with alcohol and the need for this program day by day. In June 1960, 6 months after they took my license, I went back to Atlanta to pull that board. It took about 3 minutes to restore my license without reservation and give me my narcotic privileges back too. And I've had them ever since. They congratulated me and said, "You're doing a good job, keep it up." And I walked back there with the right to practice medicine restored. But when I walked out of that courtroom, that capital that time, I think I was ready for it. I think taking away the license saved my life and gave me a chance to get membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I know that the spiritual experience wasn't enough. That the day by day, the turn to sanity, when one speaker called it, the return to sanity of knowing who I am, what I need, and what the program can do for me, and getting practice and doing it day in and day out. That part has been done. And I realized that the AA had to come ahead of everything else. That the practice of medicine had to come behind the program. That the program would let me practice medicine. But if I tried to put the practice of medicine first, I'd never be able to do that or anything else. But my sobriety depended upon my participation in AA. And I believed that then, and I believe it today. And I've continued this way, and I've tried to grow with the church. And most said, you know, I'm in alcoholic rehabilitation. I do this work. We gradually got into it over the years. And I used to hear a fellow say, look, my alcoholic rehabilitation work is what keeps me sober. But I don't believe that, because I've seen a number of my colleagues that in this work just got drunk when they got involved in it. And I know that this doesn't keep me sober. It's a drain on sobriety. Sobriety is a very personal thing. We need a personal program. And the help I try to give other people is not the help that's going to keep me sober. I've got to come here to you and get the buckets and let you fill them up. Fill up my sobriety buckets and let me take away some strength and power from you so that I can stay sober so I can do whatever work you set out for me to do. You have given me through this program a sense of purpose and a sense of fulfillment in life. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what the end result is. I don't know what the final thing is all about. But I'm comfortable with the route I'm taking. I'm comfortable with the feeling that I'm on the way somewhere and that it's in tune with God as I understand it, and it's come to me through you. You're the ones that have shown me the way and given me this feeling, and you're the people that I'm more comfortable with than anybody else. I wouldn't be anywhere else in the world right now in preference to being here with you, because it's your love and your understanding that makes this possible. We've had good things happen. We've had poor children that have found their way to up in life and doing well. We've had a lot of other things. We have a relationship in our home and in our community that I'm happy with. It's good. I feel numerous things there. The discord that flooded my life when I was thinking, I'm not aware of this anymore. The horrible world that was there is more beautiful now. The variety gives you the righteous beauty, and this is wonderful. I had problem, I guess, with God and with love as much as anything, and I got two little stories I want to tell you about that. And proof. I was sitting in a psychiatrist's office down in Florida one time, and this guy was listening to me and talking, and he said, John, what do you want? I said, I want to be a good doctor, a good father, a good husband, a good citizen. I named all those things. But he was shaking his head. He said, are you a Christian? I said, sure, I'm a Christian. I belong to Fitman Park's church and Methodist church and said, well, I don't know I'm a dime out there. I'm paid up. And he says, do you know how a Christian would answer that question? I said, how? But a Christian would say, I want to please God. So my reaction to that was that if anybody ever asked me that question again, I'll know the answer. And this is where my spiritual life operated, in this kind of thinking. I was at Lexington, and they gave me a piece of paper to fill out and said, what do you want? And I wrote on that piece of paper to please God like me. Darn sure ought to know the answer to that. I'd learn this somewhere else. And this is the way it was. You taught me through these steps that this God thing is on an experience basis. That it's something that we communicate with each other through our eyes and our personalities and our hearts. It's a feeling we have. Communication. As we sit in the meeting, and I look at you, and you look at me, and there it is. And we try to please each other and please this power that gives us this right to feel it. I was in another place, and this was a therapist office. I don't know whether you know what a therapist is or not, I'll tell you. They've got psychiatrists different kinds. They've got some psychiatrists that will give you suggestions about your life, and they've got others that'll ask leading questions, and they've got different types, but they've got one group called therapists that don't do nothing but sit and stare. And they'll sit there and they won't say a thing, and they'll look at you. And you'll be tempted to stare back, but don't do this, because they take special training in this staring, and it's impossible to make a psychiatrist blink first. There's no way. They will open their eyes in such a way that you can see the white of their eyes around the iris. And if you try to blink, to make him blink first, but you won't do it. You blink a half or two dozen times, he'll still be there and won't say a word. You just stare. This guy was doing this, and the more he did it, the more uncomfortable I became because it was costing me $50 an hour. And I didn't know whether we were getting very far. So finally, he leaned forward like that, looked over me, and said, "I love you." That sort of scared me because I was alone with this man. And I don't have these problems. I got my hat and I got out of it. I thought he'd taken advantage of us. He sat in this office with a closed door. I didn't know the door was locked or not, but I hoped not. And I got it open and I got out. And I came to AA before I realized what this man was trying to do. It was a mutual statement. He was saying, "I love you." He was trying to find out what the word love meant to me. And he did. I could not get my love, feeling of love, separated from sensual things, to sexual things. It was a confusion to me of just what it was and how you could love a man. And you taught me this. You taught me this through the experience of loving, supporting the fellowship. And now, thank God, I can say to every man in the audience here that I love you. And I can say the same thing to the ladies too. Because there's something about this love. They can name it anything they want to. But to me, the way it's expressed here in this fellowship, the way it's transmitted, is one of the real glories of my life. You can call it anything you want to, but to me, it's the redeeming grace of Almighty God. Thank you all, and God bless you.
Thank you, Dr. Jones, that very inspiring talk. You really did. Glad you could come and talk to us. If we have anyone in this group, in the radio and news media, please remember that this is a anonymous fellowship. Do not divulge the name of any person within the walls of this room. It becomes necessary that you want to use their name. Use the first name and the first letter of the last name only. That's to the respect of anonymity of everyone here. There are no duties between you, but we do have extensions. Son, Bob, and I'll pick him up. I'm just keeping an address and trying to keep him right. We get ready then. Heat now will form. I believe he just come up there, he didn't tell us.